thank you for Daniel. We thank you for getting a chance to delve into this wonderful history for 400 years that he saw in this one chapter. Thank you for the truth of the Bible and how it's always real and sure. And thank you that you're with us. We ask that you would entertain our ideas and make them exactly perfect and square them up exactly with the Bible. Let our words be pleasing to you, and we offer this, Lord, to you and ask that you would be in our midst. We come to you in the name of Jesus. Amen. Daniel 11, one of the most astounding historical books in the Bible, if not the most. I think it rivals Daniel 9's little 4-verse 70-week prophecy in that this actually is going to cover 400 years. It's called a predictive specific prophecy. This is the chapter of Daniel whereby most critics will say Daniel couldn't have written it. Because what they try to say is, oh, right, he nailed every one of these wars, every one of these leaders. Yeah, right. And he did. If you don't understand who God is, of course, then you wouldn't believe this prophecy. But let me suffice it to say that it was well established way, way before the time of Jesus. In fact, in the time that the disciples were carrying around their, quote, Bibles, they carried the Septuagint, which was written during the time of the Ptolemies we're going to talk about in this study. And Jesus himself probably used the Septuagint, which is the Greek version of the Hebrew Scriptures. This then would have been well documented before any of this other stuff happened. So it's interesting to me, people start arguing out of ignorance, not out of knowledge. Before we start Daniel 11, I want you to turn backwards a little bit, not too far. And let's turn back to Daniel 8. I'm going to start in the 3rd verse. I want to remind you and put in your remembering this particular part of a prophecy that Daniel saw. I'm in Daniel 8. I'm going to start in verse 3. Then I lifted my eyes and saw, and there standing beside the river was a man, river, was a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high. But one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. And as I was considering, suddenly a male goat came from the west across the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground, and the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Then he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. If you take your memory backwards to when we studied that, we know, of course, that what we were looking at is the end of the Persian Empire being taken over by the Greeks and the notable horn being Alexander the Great. What I love about God's prophecies are, it has been my findings that God doesn't just say it once. He says it at least twice, sometimes three or four times, so that you know this is going to be a true story. He's going to tell that story from Daniel 8 here in vivid detail. He's going to tell you how we went from the Persians, which emperors followed, which emperors followed, which emperors, and how it's going to go into the Greek Empire, and how that's going to split up into four generals. And they're going to fight that splitting up of Alexander. They're going to fight for centuries among each other till it gets it down to two generals, and they're going to fight until the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. That's the story we're looking at today. This is probably a good review to know that Daniel was taken captive at about 605 BC. About 600 years before Jesus, that young man, that sweet, precious Daniel was taken captive by Nebuchadnezzar out of Babylon. We are going to find through today's scripture that he is going to last until about 520 BC. you start putting pencil and paper that, and you're going to get over 80, closer to 90 years old. And we know that from what he dictates in these prophecies. He tells you in what year he was at. I was in the third year of Cyrus. Well, we know what Cyrus' year were because they kept very, very good histories. And so this 400 years that we're going to study today is what you will hear commonly called the silent years. From the end of Malachi, last book of the Old Testament, to the beginning of Matthew, there are scholars that say those years were silent. God wrote nothing. He told nothing. He sat silent. Don't believe it. What he does is he takes Daniel 11, and Daniel sees through prophecy what those 400 years are going to look like. And in a prophetical message, he lays those 400 years out until they're no longer silent. They're filled and filled and filled. And so anyone that tells you that, say, well, what do you do with Daniel 11? Oh, well, a lot of people don't agree that that's... Don't go there. Don't let anyone go there with you, because Jesus quotes Daniel. Several of the New Testament writers quote Daniel, and Jesus calls him a prophet. And this is a prophecy you're not going to believe. So the chapter contains one of the most specifically fulfilled prophecies of the Bible, predicting history for over 375 years. And to that end, it has amazing accuracy. This chapter is so specific, so detailed, even down to names and dates, that many critics who deny that there is such a thing as truly revelation prophecy have insisted that it is history written after the fact by somebody else calling himself Daniel. Don't buy it for a minute. But here's a point to remember. The Seleucids are going to be called the kings of the north. This is, in a nutshell, what you need to know about this chapter. When we say Seleucids, we mean north, king of north. When we say Ptolemies, we mean south, and that's Egypt. Seleucids north are Syria. Ptolemies south are Egypt. It is the same today. You have Syria at the north, Egypt at the south, and guess what lies in between? Israel. So these two grand empires are fighting with each other for juxtapositions and powers. And what happens for 400 years, 375 plus years, they're fighting between each other, crossing over, fighting, and in between is little Israel, who gets trampled on and fought on and people killed on and armies marching in. And that's the story you're going to see. So God is telling the history of what's happening to his people these 400 years. And it's not pretty. It's not a very good picture. We're going to see that the stronger group always is going to take dominion for a while. And then the other group will get stronger and then they'll take dominion for a while. This is the longest continuous prophecy in the Bible. Note that Daniel 11 is going to be the one controversial spot. If anyone has controversy in Daniel, it's going to be this one. It details events affecting the Jews from the 5th to the 1st centuries BC. From the time that Daniel was taken captive, almost up to the time of Jesus Christ appearing. And so the 10th chapter of Daniel, we saw a little setup for this. We saw a setup for the 10th chapter of Daniel where what we saw was an angel coming and giving Daniel a prophecy. And in that time, we begin now to see that this prophecy is being explained to the detail. So Daniel 10, the angel Gabriel coming, sets us up for this. And we're going to get ready to hear the rest of the explanation by the angel Gabriel of what's going to happen here. He actually explained to Daniel that he'd been dispatched by God to give Daniel the prophecy, and he'd been kind of upheld 21 days by a power we know to be in demonic influence, and Michael had to come and loose him and get him in here. So that's where we're at. We're starting where Gabriel is going to explain to Daniel even further where we're at. So we're going to go and just start right out in Daniel 11, and I'm in the first verse. And this will give you kind of the setup after you know what had happened in chapter 10. I'm in chapter 11, verse 1. Also, in the first year of Darius the Mede, right off the bat, historically you can date that because that's very well documented in Persian history. I stood up to confirm in him. Now that first verse could be very confusing to you if you had not read Daniel 2. I is Gabriel, or the angelic being that without a name, we assume it's Gabriel. It's that high angelic being, I. That angel's pointing himself, said, I, even I, stood up to confirm and strengthen him. And him is Darius. That angel, on his way to give Daniel message, was using Darius for God's purpose. So when you read that first verse, let me put in the real words here. Also in the first year of Darius the Mede, I, Gabriel, stood up to confirm and strengthen Darius. That's what that means. So you could get all mixed up and think, is he helping Daniel? No, he's helping the Medo-Persians. And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Historically, it's fairly simple to go back because Persians were wonderful at their record keeping. 539 to 530, and you do have this on your sheet. We know that that's Cyrus. Then 529 to 522 was Cambyses, and 522 was an Artaxerxes. 521 to 46 was Darius the First, also called Histopus. 486 to 465 was Xerxes, and followed by Artaxerxes Longimanus, and that's the king of Queen Esther's period. And then 334 to 323, that's when the Greek Empire came in. And those are all historical dates. There's not hardly any dispute about those. So what you're going to find then, as we are reading here, verse 1 and 2, it's talking about the Persians. We're going to get in verse 3, put a little note besides verse 3. That's the end of the Persians. Verse 3 starts the Greeks. So I'm in verse 3. Oh, wait. Let me go back and read 2 and take you into 3. 2. And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. That's the Persian kings I read you. Then verse 3. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others besides these. In the study of Greece, Alexander the Great becomes king at a very young age. He would, by the time he's 29 years old, has conquered the whole world. He dies at age 33, a very, very young age. Very, very young age to die. And what happens is, because his lineage was disreputable, he had a stepbrother who was rather an imbecile that could not take over. He had two illegitimate children, which also could not. There were no posterity of his to take over following him. And as he was dying, history records that he says this. They say, who should your kingdom go to? And Alexander the Great said it should go to the strong. Well, he had four generals, of which he was extremely fond of. A couple of them were his school chums. And they ended up partialing out his whole kingdom. So that's what when Daniel in this part says, the kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven. It's these four generals is referring to. Let me tell you who they are. There was a Cassander, a Ptolemy, Antigonus, and Seleucus. And I'm going to narrow this down in a nutshell for you because there's lots of intrigue that goes on. I mean, there's poisonings, and there's killings, and there's lyings, and there's all kinds of intrigue. But let's suffice it to say, eventually those four kingdoms get battled out to there's only two. And I told you this at the beginning, the king of the north is going to be against the king of the south. And I want you to get that picture. So those four generals fought, cheated each other and fought. And it came down to the two strongest ended up. The north are the Seleucids. That's Syria. The south are the Ptolemies, the family of the Ptolemies, and that's Egypt. That's really the nutshell of what you need to know in this study. It's going to be for 400 years, the north and south. Syria and Egypt are going to battle, and in between them is going to be little Israel. It's going to catch the brunt of all this traveling back and forth, these fightings and these battlings. So when you get to that point, you should be fairly comfortable now about knowing that history is very explicit about who the four generals are that Alexander's kingdom went to, and it will detail each territory they had. And I'm not going into that because I want you to know that the rest part is going to be narrowed down to the two big guys on the block, and that's Seleucid North, Ptolemy South. And that, from now on, it's going to be King of North against the King of the South. I think about today, and I think it doesn't ever change. I mean, Egypt and Syria are still battling Israel. Nothing changes. And it won't until the King of Kings makes everything right. And I think that's what we're going to see. The first indication of the two-way split, we're getting ready to read in that. I'm in verse 5. This is going to kind of set you up for the two big guys taking over. I'm in verse 5. Also, the King of the South shall become strong. Now, remember I told you that's the Ptolemies, that's Egypt. As well as one of his princes, that's his son. And he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. Okay, that verse tells you, we've narrowed it down to now, one of the big guys is the king of the south. That's the Ptolemies. That's verse 5. That's what you're learning from that. And that happens in about 281 BC, when Seleucus actually killed Lysimachus in battle. That left only the two big guys. I'm in verse 6. And at the end of some years, they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of her authority, and neither he nor his authority, and neither he nor his authority shall stand, but she shall be given up with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. Let me read to you in your own terms what exactly happened there. Antiochus II, his name was also named Theos, is the character we're going to see here. Because in 249, the king of the south, Ptolemy II, remember the Ptolemies are the south, he was also called Philadelphus. If you're following, you have a chart, and then you're going to follow right here's where you are. And they're going to name them. So maybe you can follow that and just listen to me. In 249, the king of the south, Ptolemy II, also called Philadelphus, sent his daughter Bernice to the king of the north, Antiochus II, also called Theos. Why would he do that? It has always been known that if two warring factions can marry kids together, typically they join a union and they don't fight anymore. This was the idea of the king. He thinks he's doing a real trick here, which I guess we'll see what happens. But his plan to stop the war that was raging, because they're always fighting. And that by uniting those two kingdoms together through the marriage of his daughter Bernice to the king at that time of his enemy, Theos. Okay? Now here's what happened. This is intrigue, intrigue, intrigue. This had a flaw in the plan. Big flaw. That king was already married. And even in that day, it was not good if you tried to marry somebody who's already married. So here's what happened. Antiochus II was already married. However, because he realized that if he married Ptolemy II's daughter Bernice, that would ensure peace, allow his kingdom to gain most of the Syrian possessions of his father that had lost in another battle. So what Antiochus did, what some men today would not think twice about, he put away his wife, Laodicea, and he gave her up and married Bernice. Now, I don't know how he did it, but he did. So he put Laodicea away, married Bernice. And Bernice persuaded him to even disown his own children with Laodice. She said, put them away too. So Bernice is quite a conniver. She has talked to this new husband of hers, not only to do away with his wife, but to do away with the children. I'm not talking kill. I'm talking like put him away privately. Okay. So she persuaded him to reject Laodicea's children and set up her own. She had children with him to succeed to the throne. So now she's in good. She's the queen. Her kids are in, and she thinks she's solid in there. Well, that's not how it works. Okay. However, after her father died, after Ptolemy II died in 246, Antiochus realized that he really loved his first wife. So he did away with his marriage to Bernice, left her and their infant son, and returned to his first wife, Laodice. Does this sound like a soap opera? Doubting his faithfulness, and this woman is not stupid, Laodice, the first wife, goes, I'm not sure if I believe him. But she went further than that. She murdered him by giving him poison in his food. So then now at this time, her son was older. He was late teens. So she convinced her son, Seleucus II, also called Callinicus, that is Laodice's son, to kill both Bernice and her baby son.
Oh boy.
So, just as the prophecy said in this verse, Ptolemy II, king of the south, his daughter Bernice, and Antiochus II, king of the north, all lost their lives in the struggle for power. And that all happened in one verse. Are you pretty impressed so far?
Yes.
And history proves all this to be true. Now, I want to tell you this. Let me remind you what's happening. This angel, Gabriel, is telling Daniel this 400 years before it happens. And he's saying, or some of it's 200, some of it's 300. Anyways, it's in Daniel's future. And he's giving him the vivid details about this. All right, now let's go to the next verse. It gets better. I'm in now verse 7. Get ready for this. But from a branch of her roots, one shall arise in his place, who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with him and prevail. All right. We now have Ptolemy III, whose name was Euergetes. And he's the eldest son of Ptolemy II, and he's Bernice's brother. Remember Bernice, who got murdered. And he was not happy that his sister had been murdered. Well, of course he wasn't. So he immediately invaded the Seleucid Empire. Now watch what happens. His armies defeat the forces of the new king of the north, which was Seleucus II, who was the son of Antiochus and Laodice. His campaign was successful, and his armies achieved victory from the Tigris River to the coast of Asia Minor. And so Ptolemy III captured and put to death Laodice, who had murdered his sister. He was even able to enter Seleucia, the port city of Tigris River, on the capital of Antioch, and leave a garrison there. We now have, do you see how intriguing all these murders are? And do you see that in these verses, Daniel sees this? So we are now ready for verse 8. Let's go on. Is it getting more interesting? Are you loving this? All right, we're in verse 8. And he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold. And he shall continue more years than the king of the north. Now, that's considered the third Syrian war. During that war, the king of the south, which was Ptolemy III, is credited with recovering many of the sacred statues that the Persian forces of Cambyses had carried off some 300 years before. So there are some gold articles and there are some precious things. Because of this, he was known as Euergetes, or benefactor, because he was able to capture back some of the things that had been stolen. Ptolemy III acquired much gold and silver during his victorious campaign. In fact, from Seleucia alone, he received 4,000 talents of gold, 1,500 talents of silver as a tribute, and that was about 10% of their income he accepted every year as tribute. And he outlived Seleucus II, who died after falling from his horse by 4 or 5 years. All right, now I want to inject something right here. And we are going to go on. It gets better and better. And I know this is a lot of detail. So bear with me. I want to say all that to say this. Many people study Daniel 11, and they overread it and go, oh, that's good, and go on. And I understand that for an overview of history, you get a picture of what's going on for 400 years between the end of the Old Testament till Jesus Christ. I get that. And I understand that if you want to do this in real detail, you'd take each one of these battles, you'd name the generals, you'd name the different skirmishes, you'd name the people involved. I'm giving you a highlight of what's happening to prove that Daniel 11 is true. If it's good enough for you to just do these highlights, that's great. You've got enough information here in historical books that you can dig further. If you want to know more about Ptolemy III, then by all means, it's easy to find a lot about him. I could have spent 16 weeks on this chapter. But I'm trying to give you highlights and hope that it makes sense to you how true Daniel is, and that you're starting to get the picture. The north is Syria, the Seleucids. The south is Egypt, the Ptolemies. And they're fighting back. These have trickled down from the four generals of Alexander the Great. They fought it out to these two big guns. The two Kola gorillas on the block are fighting for 400 years till it finally ends up not well for any of them. But I wanted to stop and say, it's a lot of detail, but is way more if you really want to go into it. So continuing on, I hope that's a good explanation of why we're even doing this. We've talked now about verse 8. Let's go on to 9. Also the king of the north, he shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. In 240 BC, the king of the north, which by then is Seleucus II, if you're following your chart, okay, attempted to invade Egypt, the king of the south, in response to the humiliation he had suffered at the hands of Ptolemy III. However, he had to return in defeat after his entire fleet perished in a storm. That particular thing is really worth looking at. I mean, that was a God thing. So I'm just going to suffice that to say enough about that. But that's what happened to him. Now, I want to ask you as an insert here, does this parallel with any news you're hearing today? Or is it one battle after another every time you turn the news on? And isn't it the same players that we're seeing? Just thought I'd throw that in. Always, by the way, for your information, if you're following this, I hope this helps. Does? Okay. Because to me, I'm a visual person. It's like, I can't get this otherwise. All right. So we are now on verse 10. However, his sons shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through, then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. Let me explain that. The sons of Seleucus II were Seleucus III, also called Crinoas or Thunder, and Antiochus III, also called Antiochus the Great. Seleucus III, the eldest son of Seleucus II, began a war against the Egyptian provinces in Asia Minor. So what happened is Egyptian forces were up in Turkey, and the Seleucids came down to battle. It's not new. North, south. They're battling the whole time. It's just a different generation, it's different names. However, he was not successful and was assassinated by members of his own army. They liked him a lot, didn't they? In Asia Minor in 223 BC. Seleucus' second younger son, Antiochus III. Pay attention to him. This Antiochus III is also called Antiochus the Great. He does a lot of things. He's not the Antiochus that Jesus refers to as Epiphanes. He's his father. But he's setting us up for what we're going to really study, and that's the Epiphanes. Antiochus III took the throne at age 18 after his brother's death. In 219 to 218 BC, Antiochus III victoriously went through Judea, coming almost to the borders of Egypt. He's called the Great because he regains the property that all these other misfit generals had lost. And he's coming down, and he's coming through Judea, and he gets almost to the edge of Egypt, and he wins all his land back. He's called the Great because he was a great general, not because he's a really great person. But he's going to be the father of somebody we want to pay real close attention to. So, we're in verse 10 some more. Antiochus III then and his eldest son was Seleucus III, and they began the war against the Egyptian provinces because he took it really close, right down to the edge. He went victoriously through Judea, but here's an interesting thing. God stops him at doing something he chose to do. I'm not saying he's the great because he's a good man. He was so victorious getting back all his land that he got into Judea, he got into Jerusalem, and he decided he was going to go into the Holy of Holies. God stopped him in his tracks, and he paralyzed him. History says that Antiochus III also named himself Epiphanes, but not so much as four. But he got right to the border of the temple, was going to go in, and God paralyzed the spot. And if you read history about it, it is a strange occurrence. So God stops Antiochus III from going into the temple. You need to know, he's not the one that desecrated the temple. He would have. I truly believe he had a heart to do it, because that was his intent, and God stopped him. He wasn't the right one. Don't you love that? I'm in verse 11. And the king of the south shall be moved with rage and go out and fight with him, with the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude. But the multitude shall be given into the hand of his enemy. Now Antiochus III met Ptolemy IV, who's also named Philopater, at the Battle of Raphia, also known as the Battle of Gaza in 217. Antiochus III, that's also called Antiochus the Great, the king of the north, had 62,000 infantry, 6,000 cavalry, and 103 war elephants. I just think some of these things are interesting, you need to know. But Ptolemy IV, who was the king of the south, was able to win with less troops and less equipment. So Antiochus III was forced to withdraw back to Lebanon. So all that part that he had won before, he lost back some of it. This is a seesaw of battles. If I can explain it, when I was trying to draw it, it's like a zigzag. I win. No, you win. No, I win back. And it's, think what little Judea, little Israel, she's right in the middle of this king of the north, king of the south, this battle. And can you imagine bringing 103 war elephants right into the midst of Judea and then battling there? I'm sure everything was trampled on and destroyed. And you're going to find this seesawing effect. You're not going to find one getting the best of another, because it's going to go back and forth. And that's what Daniel saw. And with such detail, he detailed this, that when you lay it next to their history, it's, oh yeah, that's who that, yes. Yeah, history book says this. You can lay it parallel to history. That's why so many people, when you do Daniel 11, say, he couldn't have written that. Some guy wrote this down and tried to pawn it off as a fraud that Daniel would. No, it was being carried around by people way before any of this happened. So that's just a lie. Going on, more details in verse 12. When he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. So after the victory over Antiochus III, remember Ptolemy IV had won. Ptolemy IV spent only 3 months settling his affairs in the Holy Land before heading back down to Alexandria. He was apparently eager to return to his luxurious and decadent life in Egypt. He was known to be quite a rounder. And in his haste to go home, Ptolemy IV left the important port of Seleucia in Pyrgia on the Phoenician coast, which his father had captured before, in the hands of Antiochus III. And after his victory at Gaza, the Egyptian troops trained to fight the Seleucids began a successful guerrilla campaign against the ruling Egypt. And by the time of the end of Ptolemy IV's reign, they had achieved total independence in the southern part of Egypt. So he went home to play. He lost his port. That's what that's saying. And you know what? Nothing changes today. Our leaders don't take care of stuff. We lose our gains. I think about Iraq. And I'm not trying to be political here. But you don't take care of business, you lose your gains. And that's what happened in that particular verse in verse 12. I'm in verse 13, continuing on. Do you imagine that Daniel has trouble writing all this down? He's saying, okay, God, I guess you mean this. And are you sure, God? And Gabriel's telling all this, and Daniel's writing, he's close to 85 years old, writing this in such vivid detail and not understand really what any of it meant. I love it. Verse 13, for the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come to the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. So, let's set it up like this. After the death of Ptolemy IV, and you're following your chart, I'm sure, in 204 BC, Antiochus III, which is also called the Great, rallied his forces again to attack the kingdom of the south. I don't know if you're counting how many times Antiochus III is going against the south, but it's always, this is going to be the always seesaw, north against the south, Syria against Egypt, Ptolemies against Seleucid, over and over and over and back and forth, and that's exactly what happens. He rallied his troops in the fifth Syrian war. Now, we've done five of these. This is the fifth one, and it states 202 to 195. Antiochus III swept down into Judea. That's Israel. He comes across Israel from Syria. Of course, he's trampling over holy ground again. He retook the territory that he'd occupied some 18 years previously. But here's a big but. When Antiochus III withdrew for winter, in other words, he kind of gave up some of his strong ground, the Egyptian commander Scopas reconquered the southern part of the Lost Area, and guess what? Including Judea and Jerusalem. So there was one more battle in Judea. In fact, I'm pointing out to you that this every one of these battles involves Israel. It's not that they're fighting. They don't have troops out fighting. But their land is being fought among. I mean, these two battles are always the north. Syria is coming against Egypt south. And they're right in between. So that's what we see again. And the intrigue goes on. Here's verse 14. Now in these times, many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision. They shall fall. Okay. Antiochus III, also called the Great, negotiated an alliance. Now he's going to bring somebody else with King Philip of Macedonia. If that name sounds familiar to you, that is the so-called father of Alexander the Great. Philip of Macedon. He's going to bring in a little bit of some Greek influence here. And he's going to make an alliance with King Philip V of Macedonia to divide up Egypt's Asian's possessions. After some temporary setbacks, the wars that were happening in Gaza, can we say Israel? Mm-hmm, that was happening then. Antiochus III's army inflicted a crushing defeat on the Ptolemies about 199 BC. See, we're going down in history now. That was at an area called Panias, and it was right near the Jordan River. Can we say Israel? Every one of these. I hope I'm beginning to make a point here. Regarding the prophesied action of the Jews, the Jewish historian Josephus wrote this. We get a lot of details from Josephus. I quote him a lot. I never say he's biblical. He's not, but he is a historian. If you want to know ancient history, he's very, very bona fide and very well respected. Here's what Josephus says. Yet was it not long afterward when Antiochus overcame Scopas in a battle fought at the fountains of the Jordan and destroyed a great part of his army, but afterward when Antiochus subdued those cities of Caesarea where Scopas had gotten into his possession and Samaria with him, the Jews of their own accord went over to him and received him into their city of Jerusalem and gave plentiful provision to his army and to his elephants. This is noted by Josephus, and readily assisted him when he besieged the garrison, which was the citadel of Jerusalem. Unfortunately, this Jewish assistance was not to be remembered when Antiochus IV later came against Jerusalem. And here's what Josephus wanted you to note. When Antiochus III got in a little trouble, the Jews helped him. They fed his troops. They fed his elephants. They really were kind of rooting for him more than for the king of the south. And what happens is Antiochus IV, who's his son, is going to come in with such vengeance on Jerusalem. I think they're taken aback by that because they thought they had pledged allegiance and helped. And that's an interesting note there from Josephus. I'm in verse 15. Then the king of the north shall come and throw up siege works and take a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not stand, or even his best troops, for there shall be no strength to stand. Following that defeat at Panias, Scopas fled to the fortified city of Sidon, but after Antiochus III had besieged it, Scopas surrendered in 199 BC. In exchange for safe passage out of the city back to Egypt, he and his troops were allowed to leave the city naked. And there's a real, the history says, real shame. They took everything away from it and they walked naked out, giving up all their weapons, went back to Egypt. Verse 16. And in ancient world, stripping someone naked like that was a real, these troops never forgot it, and they come back later in exact vengeance. Verse 16. But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power. If you don't know by now, glorious land always means Israel. Always. Promised land, glorious land, it's always Israel. So that should be a heads up to you. We know they've been fighting there anyway, but now this one's really going to target it. So, with that final victory over Scopas at Sidon, Antiochus the Great, and that, remember, is the third, took the Holy Land away from the Egyptians for good. For good. So, for now, the Egypt can no longer go into the Holy Land. Judea and Jerusalem had passed from the king of the south and is now totally controlled by the king of the north. That's an important thing to note, and that's in verse 16. That's where no longer does Egypt have any claim to the promised land, the glorious land. Verse 17. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do. And he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or be for him. I want to give you another intriguing story. I gave you the story of Bernice and Laodice, that marriage and poisoning and all that. Oh, this gets better. You're going to know this name. Let's listen to this one. Now, young Ptolemy V, by this time it starts, he's about 8 years old. We're talking young. It's about 197 BC. Had entered into a treaty with Antiochus III, that's Antiochus the Great, after his military defeat in that fifth Syrian war we already talked about. Remember when he was defeated? Through this treaty, Antiochus III tried to strengthen his position with another marriage of sorts here. Now listen to this one. And expand his empire that he had lost and regain again. So Ptolemy V surrendered his Asian holdings to the king of the north and accepted Antiochus the Third's daughter, whose name was Cleopatra, as a bride. There is controversy if it's the Cleopatra we all think of as movie-ish Cleopatra. It may not be. It was a fairly common name, but it is her name. And I am the one that takes everything literally. And so, for me, it seems more likely that it is the famous one that we know. I can't prove that. No one else can either. It is her name. And if you want to take it literally, that's her name. So, let's go back. So, that Antiochus III's daughter, Cleopatra, is given as a bride to young Ptolemy V. She had to wait a few years till he got old enough to really be married to her, although he married her as a child. I love these stories. They were married in 194 BC. And through this marriage, Antiochus the Great then got a foothold into Egypt through his daughter. He thought, and I want to say this, he thought his daughter was on his side, and he married her to this little boy, thinking, she'll find somebody else and have an affair on the side. This little boy grew up to be a really handsome young man. The history says very comely, and she fell in love with him. They were actually married for a long time before she actually really became his wife, but she fell in love with him, and this put a wrench in the plans of Antiochus III. So his plan backfired on him. Cleopatra was a true wife to Ptolemy V and loved him. And she fell in love with him against her father's will. And what happened was, because she fell in love with Ptolemy, she also fell in love with Egypt, and the Egyptian people loved her because they saw she loved this young king, and they saw that she was not like her father who had tried to trick him. And so what happens is exactly what Daniel said, that he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or be for him. That's just what Daniel said in verse 17. When you understand that she fell in love with that young king, And they were very, very happy together. So true love can win. So she loved her husband and turned from her father. And that we're looking now at about 196. I'm in verse 18. Isn't this good? I think that Daniel saw all this. I just think it's miraculous. This is one, I'm going to stop here and brag a little bit on Daniel, but most phenomenal prophecies in the Bible. In verse after verse is like years of history that are just nailing it. And they're in the perfect order. They're exactly how they happened in history and exactly the things that he says does. You can go back and anyone that ever doubted Daniel 11, lay it next to an ancient history book because it's all this intrigue is in there. And I've just picked out some high points. There's other things going on too, so you don't want to be here for 16 more weeks. We'll just shorten it down. I'm in verse 18. And this, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall take many, but a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to an end. And with the reproach removed, he shall turn back on him. Now that Antiochus III, remember, got kind of hoodwinked by his daughter. So he crossed into Greece to see if he could help them, and he sent ambassadors to Rome asking for their friendship, because I want to tell you what's happening in history. Just like Daniel saw Nebuchadnezzar's dream, yeah, actually we saw Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon, and then we saw who came up, Persia, Mede, and then we saw Greece, and then we saw that Rome coming up on that statue, and what's happening is Rome is starting to rise its ugly head. During this last of the Greek Empire, they're starting to get some power. They hadn't at this point. And this Antiochus III, Antiochus the Great, began to see Rome looming. And he thought, oh, I better make some friendships with them. They're starting to get powerful. So that's what he did. The Romans sent Rome asking for friendship. However, big however here, the Roman Senate replied that they would be friends only if Antiochus III left the Greeks in Asia free and independent, and if he kept away from Europe where they were. Now, that's not what he wanted to hear. So Antiochus III refused and went to war against Rome. This guy was great, but he made some really fatal errors, we're going to find out here later. With 10,000 men, Antiochus III sailed across the Aegean Sea and took some strongholds in Asia Minor, which is Turkey. But in doing so, he made one of his former allies, remember when he tried to become friends with King Philip of Macedonia? Remember Alexander the Great's so-called father? He tried to be friends with. This made him mad, and so now Greece is against him. The Roman army entered Asia Minor and defeated the larger forces of Antiochus III, so Rome beats him. This is where Rome is starting to come into power. And at the Battle of Magnesia in 190 BC, in the Peace Treaty of Apamina in 188 BC, Roman general Publius Scipio set a high cost on Antiochus III for peace. He demanded, now this is interesting, pay attention, this is big, because Rome beat him, he had to pay up in many ways. He had to give up land, but here's what else Rome demanded. They demanded 20 hostages to be given to them, including his son, Antiochus IV. And I want you to pay attention to this. Antiochus IV is the son that we are going to spend a lot of time on, especially next week, and we're going to lay him on top of the Antichrist. He's called Epiphanes. We're seeing him as a young man. His father loses this battle to Rome, and because he stupidly went against Rome, who knows even why, he's not even the one he should be battling. They demand that he send his son as hostage to Rome. Now, let me remind you who Rome actually becomes. One of the most brutal, most heinous, most angry, most aggravating empires that comes. They're the ones that crucified Jesus. They're the ones that develop crucifixion. This is who Rome is. He sends his son to be taken captive by Rome for a few years. He learns their ways. I hope this begins to... Antiochus IV, as a young man, is going to be shipped off to Rome as a hostage because his father lost the battle. But he's going to learn things in Rome that's going to change history. He's going to get a brutality and a mentality of meanness that we've not seen before coming from the Romans because he's going to be influenced by them. So this is a big deal. A reduction of naval ships to 12, so they took away his naval ships, and a payment to Rome for the cost of the war totaling 15,000 of silver over the next 12 years. The all-consuming ambition of Antiochus III, Antiochus the Great, has finally brought defeat to the kingdom of the north. Wow. We saw the south falling. Now I want you to take a look. This is pretty much the downfall of the north in chapter, in verse 18. I hope there was a lot in that. I hope that the one thing I made a point is because he was stupid and went against Rome, he not only lost most of his land, he had to give up his son to be taken to Rome. That's what I want to set you up for. And I'm in verse 19, okay? I know, by the way, I want to stop here. I know this is a lot of history. And I know most people, it's more than you want to hear. But it's if I set you up with enough details to show you who Antiochus Epiphanes is and how we're going to lay him later on to be the picture of the Antichrist, that's the whole purpose of giving you the background of this. Okay, and if I'm going too fast, just me, but we've got lots to cover. And I'm in verse 19. Then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. Now, as a consequence of that Roman victory over Antiochus III, those outlying provinces of the Seleucid Empire, they began to ask for their independence because they realized that Antiochus was no more. And with his kingdom now reduced to Syria, Mesopotamia, and western Iran, Antiochus III was in dire need of money. Remember, he had to give a lot back to Rome when he lost, with which to pay Rome for the cost of the war. He really was cash struck here. In 187 BC, while attempting to plunder a pagan temple in Babylon near Susa, he was murdered. This is the end of Antiochus III. He ended in the gruesome way that he lived. Going into a pagan temple, somebody murdered him. I just think the justice of God is just true, isn't it? So we're continuing on, verse 20. His successor will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. In a few years, however, he will be destroyed, yet not in anger or in a battle. Now, so actually, Antiochus III had an older son. His name was Seleucus IV, or Philopater. If you see it across on your chart, you'll know it. He took over after his father's death. Remember, his father's murdered, okay? Due to the heavy debt, though, that he had been imposed upon by Rome, he was forced to try to get money somehow to pay this debt to Rome. So he started a terrible taxation policy. And remember, his empire now has been shrunk to about a third of what it was. So these few little provinces he has, he taxes them mercilessly. This included taxation on the people of, guess where? Israel! You got it! He starts taxing Judea! In fact, Seleucus IV even sent his treasurer, Heliodorus, to the temple in Jerusalem to extract money. He even went into the temple. The Roman Senate decided to trade hostages, therefore, and they ordered Seleucus IV to send his son, Demetrius, the heir to the throne, to Rome. So, see, there's something going on with these Romans wanting more hostages. So, now Seleucus has to send his son. In return, the Roman released Seleucus IV's younger brother, Antiochus IV. This is the guy we're looking at. So there was a hostage exchange. And Antiochus IV now is coming home. He's been in Rome several years. He has been instructed in their ways. He's watched their cruelty. Probably been a victim of their cruelty. And he's got a lot now in his mind. When released, Antiochus IV went to Athens. And in 175 BC, after Demetrius had been sent away to Rome, remember, they're doing a switch. Seleucus IV was poisoned by his minister, Helodrius. Intrigue, didn't want him to be head of the Seleucus Empire, so his mentor or his minister poisons him. Some historians think that actually Helodrius desired the throne for himself, but others believe this. There is no discounting the timing of this, because as Antiochus IV is just coming home, his brother's king, isn't it interesting that just as he's coming home, he just mysteriously gets poisoned by a minister, and that makes Antiochus IV king. Who do you suppose put that minister up to it? History can't prove it, but it does make more sense to me that Antiochus IV, remember, having been trained in Rome with all their vicious ways, poisoned his own brother for the throne. Does that make sense? Can't prove it, but we know the minister did it. We just can't prove that Antiochus IV was behind it, but I'm sure he was. Now, Seleucus' young son, which was Antiochus, age 5, was put on the throne in his place. But actually, Helodrius becomes the power. So Antiochus the 4th is waiting in the wings. This little boy is king, and this minister is kind of the vassal king. We've got this Antiochus the 4th waiting. Can you say murder and intrigue? I think so. Which brings us up to 21. Hope all this is making sense of what's happening to get to the place we're at. I'm in verse 21. And in his place shall arise a vile person. I want that to be a particular note to you. It is the same topology, the same symbolism as always seems to accompany the Antichrist. We're going to see this vile person, this root of that word, often laid on top of the Antichrist. So we're already starting to get a foreshadowing. I'm going to say that from the next 15 verses or so are going to be about one vile person. They are. And he's historically a real person. And I can prove that to you. And you can look up in any history book. He's real. But I'm going to say it's more than that. I'm going to try to prove to you, as Isaiah does many times, Daniel's doing it too, that it goes deeper and deeper and deeper. And yes, it is Antiochus the 4th Epiphanes. Yes, it is. Yes, he was real. But I think it's going to foreshadow this last Antichrist that we've yet to see. And I think Daniel's showing you that in this one man, you're going to see a real profile of the man to come that's coming in the tribulation. So pay attention. The next 15 verses or so are about a particular leader, but I think they're also about 2,000 years down the road when this real vile person comes up. That's what we call a foreshadowing, and Daniel does it very well. I'm in verse 21. And in his place shall arise a vile person to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. Now you remember when Seleucus IV was dead, the rightful heir was young Demetrius. However, he was no longer available, had been sent to Rome as a hostage. Remember, he traded for him. Okay. Now, at the time of his murder, Antiochus IV was in Athens. However, when he heard of his brother's death, he quickly sailed to Pergamum. And once there, he sought the help of Eumenes II, the king of Pergamum. But by flattering Eumenes and his brother Attalus, he received their support and backing, and Antiochus IV then arrived in Seleucia with a powerful ally and thwarted Herodias' design on the throne. He became co-regent and protector of Seleucus IV's infant son, who was 5 years old, also named Antiochus. What they don't always tell you there is that many people believe that even though he was out of town, that his money and influence had got this minister person to kill his brother, put this little boy, age 5, on the throne. And now Antiochus IV has sailed back from the help of the kings of Pergamus, and he set himself up next to this little boy. Boy, I would not want to be that little boy. And this, they have this minister who did the poisoning suddenly murdered. Gee, would that give away any evidence that he might know? I think so. So any evidence that Antiochus IV was involved has been murdered. Does it get that? Intrigue. Verse 22. With the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, also the Prince of the Covenant. The Prince of the Covenant is a really interesting reference. Let's go on. I'll pull that up. Now, because he was a real charmer, Antiochus IV renamed himself Epiphanes, which means God manifest. He believes he is God in the flesh, and he doesn't believe in our God. He believes in Zeus. So what Antiochus IV really believes is that he's Zeus in the flesh, or God manifest, was able to overcome all of his threats to the throne. The Prince of the Covenant here is a reference to the Jewish high priest Onias III. It is historically proven that at the time all this was happening, that in the temple, the high priest of the temple, which I got to tell you, remember Jesus' story, they're not always very good men. The high priests were often bought off. Look what they did to Jesus. Not new here. So this guy is not what you call sterling. Okay, so Onias III was the high priest at the time of Antiochus IV and when he came to throne. And he was a brother of Onias, was also named Joshua, who had become Hellenized and changed his name to Jason, and he made a deal with Antiochus IV. Boy, the details on this. Jason told him he would pay Antiochus IV a large bribe if he would remove Onias, the high priest, and make him high priest in his place. Jason wanted his brother killed too. So what he does is he says to Antiochus IV, I'll help you if you help me. You get my brother Onias, high priest, killed, because I want to be high priest. And I'll help you become king and set you up as the kingdom. And so these two wonderful people, can't we all say, aha, go together and they work up a deal. And here's the deal they made. So Antiochus IV forced Onias out and installed his brother Jason as high priest in Jerusalem in 174 BC. And in 172, Jason sent a priest named Malleus to Antiochus IV with his tribute money. However, Malleus took Jason's money, added some of his own to it, and bribed Antiochus IV to secure the high priesthood for himself. So there's no real friends here. Malleus then returned to Jerusalem and kicked out Jason, who fled for his life. And Antiochus IV's double cross of Jason shows the nature of his true character. I think in that intrigue, there were three different high priests that took and lots of money exchanged. Can you see who Antiochus IV is? Can you see his character? That was the note that one commentator said. If anyone doubted what he's like, I mean, he's just deposing one high priest after another because of money. He did three in a row right there. And in 170 BC, the younger Antiochus, remember who was sitting on the throne at age 5, was murdered. Gee, are we surprised here? While Antiochus IV was conveniently absent, I wonder where, paving the way for him now to be the sole ruler and sole possession of the throne. And in 71 BC, he murdered the other high priest too. This is Antiochus IV. And I know it gets confusing, but I think you can see enough of what's happening here. That in that one verse, he deposed three different high priests for money and then finally killed the last one. And he figured out a way to get that little boy king killed while he was conveniently out of town. And now he's ruler. So that's where we're at in verse 23. We have Antiochus IV as rulership. Whew. Are you confused yet? Or are you following it? You've got this. It helps maybe too. Following it right down the road. Okay. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. Okay. The king of the north has set his sights on the kingdom of the south. This is not surprising. It's the same battle. Remember, I told you it's going to be a battle continue. So in Egypt, we had a 14-year-old king named Ptolemy the VI, Philometor, who had become king. He's young. He's 14 years old. He was actually the nephew of Antiochus IV. Remember, his mother was Cleopatra, and that's actually Antiochus IV's sister. So Antiochus IV sought an alliance with Ptolemy the VI. This is his 14-year-old, seeking to take advantage of what he perceived as a weakness because of his age, and that maybe he could gain Egypt for himself. Well, surprise, surprise, he moved through Syria, moved down through Syria, and guess where he goes through? Israel. He comes right on down with a small army so as not to arouse suspicion of his true motive, and he marches into Egypt and seizes him. His cover story when he was coming to act as his real protector for his nephew, Ptolemy the VI. You suppose anybody bought that story? Don't know. Verse 24, he shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. So actually, Antiochus IV now has devised this great plan for coming into Egypt and controlling its provinces because he says he's going to help his nephew. And he moved into parts of that kingdom where they're very richest. He's also strapped for money, remember that. So he did something that no other Seleucid king had ever done. Remember, he's marched into the south. The north has marched into the south. No one else had done that. Antiochus IV spread around some of the spoils from his war to secure the loyalty of his people. And what he did is, when he went into Egypt, he got gold and stuff. And to make sure people didn't turn against him and murder him, because that's been happening all around, he started handing out tokens to people. This is where the verse you might write beside it, Robin Hood took from the rich, gave to the poor, and he was beginning to buy favors with the people. he would steal little gold idols, and he would steal silver coins, and he would generously, quote, hand them out to the people. Let's see how that works out for him. I turn to the historical book of the Maccabees. If you've not read that, it is an apocryphal book. The Catholic Bible has it, and it details so much of this, and I'm going to bring the Maccabees in here, how they end all this. It's a true historical thing. It is not in our canon of the Bible. I'm not sure why. It's pretty warlike. But from 1 Maccabees 3:30, it is reported that this Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, would go into the streets and throw money to the citizens. However, this was just the beginning of his plan, because he was going to be cunning, and as he was visiting Egyptian strongholds, giving people money, he was searching out their power. He was scoping out and spying out their armies. So this was all for a reason. The poor Egyptians didn't get it. And they really liked him. Just like, can I say this? Equating it to today, we have very many poor, stupid people that are getting handouts from the government, and they really like it. But look at the ulterior motive. I think that's really what this verse says. I think you can take it even to where we are today. That's a Lindaism. That's not Bible, and that's not history. That's my thoughts. Because I think everything on these verses can be applied to us. So I think that's exactly what I'm seeing. So I'm in verse 25. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army. But he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. So in 170 BC, when Antiochus IV Epiphanes felt secure about the state of his kingdom, he decided to now take Egypt by force. Remember, he'd given out money, he'd set the people up, he'd deceived them. And it's called the Sixth Syrian War. He regarded Ptolemy VI, remember he's the son of Cleopatra, supposedly a cousin, as a weak ruler and therefore not capable of successfully waging war against him. Antiochus IV was able to move his army to the border of Egypt before he was met by the Egyptians at Pelusium, which is near the Nile Delta. The Egyptians had a large army arrayed against him there. Antiochus, risking death by riding into the midst of the battle at Pelusium, ordered the Egyptian to be taken alive instead of slain. And by this policy, he gained Pelusium and later took the territory of Memphis. Verse 26, yes, those who eat of this portion of this delicacy shall destroy him, his army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Ptolemy VI's army, although large, was not able to withstand Antiochus IV, Epiphanes. So in a large part, this was due because, remember, Epiphanes had set up all these intrigues and had corrupted Egyptian people and ministers and bought them over, and they become his friends. This was one of the main causes of the defeat of Ptolemy VI, because Epiphanes had gone in and won people over by giving him stuff. Those who were in his confidence and possessed the secrets of the state betrayed him to. They betrayed all Ptolemy's to Antiochus IV. For example, Ptolemy Macron, also called Ptolemy the son of Doramenes, had been appointed by Ptolemy VI as governor of Cyprus. However, sensing the young king's weakness, he deserted to Antiochus IV, who made him governor of Syria and Phoenicia. Intrigue, intrigue. And see, Antiochus IV is smart. Don't discount that the Antichrist will be smart. He's going to come in with flatteries. He's going to come in with gifts, promises, and he's going to look great. That's why I want to keep saying I think we can go deeper with this. Antiochus IV came in. He didn't just tromp into Egypt. He came in peacefully, said, I'm coming here to help my cousin. And he said, oh, these rich people don't need this. And he starts giving all this stuff away. He wins the non-thinking people over, so that when he came as a force to take them over, they willingly went. I think we're going to see the same thing with the Antichrist. I think he's going to win people over, woo, 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 and win them over. And I think when he comes in with his force, they're already going to be sucked under. I think it's the same story. I'm in verse 27. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper, for the end shall be at the appointed time. After he took those provinces of Pelusium and Memphis, Antiochus IV set his sights on Alexandria. That's the big gun, big place. Due to the intrigues of Antiochus IV, The Alexandrians had renounced their allegiance to Ptolemy VI and had made his younger brother, Ptolemy VII, Euergetes, king in his place. So now we have a new Ptolemy. While at Memphis, Antiochus IV and Ptolemy VI had frequent conferences. Because they were supposedly cousins, they supposedly met at the same table and talked and had dinner together and supposedly shared secrets. This is what history says. It's a rue on the point of Antiochus IV. He's setting this Ptolemy up for a fall. And some people are stupid enough, like some of our leaders, to believe the lies that are told them, and they make treaties with them. Does that remind you of anyone you know? Just putting it out there. Antiochus IV professed his great friendship to this nephew and his concern for his interests. Yeah, he said, I'm going to take care of you, and his concern. They're eating dinner together, but this true plan was to weaken Egypt by setting brothers against each other. And conversely, Ptolemy VI professed gratitude to his uncle for the interest he had taken in him. He laid the blame of the war upon his minister, Eulaeus. And all the while, Ptolemy VI sought to smooth over things with his brother, Ptolemy VII, so they could join forces against their deceitful uncle, Antiochus IV. And if you follow that at all, they're both using each other. Antiochus IV is with Ptolemy VI and saying, I'm going to help you. But Ptolemy VI is trying to meet with his brother Ptolemy VII, trying to get back with him. And it's a round circle of lies. Does this remind you of the UN in any ways? All these different leaders coming, they're eating, they're being so, they're playing nice with each other. Oh, it's all wonderful. And they're all plotting against them, against somebody else. And I wanted to write, besides this verse, United Nations. Do you suppose Daniel, when he saw this, looked a little further past and saw that same thing happening in our time? I think so. I said, I think I can take these verses deeper and deeper for you. You don't have to buy it if you don't want to. I can't prove that. I'm telling you what it seems like to me. I can tell you this actually happened in history. Verse 28, while returning to this land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the Holy Covenant, so he shall do damage and return to his own land. Well, now we have Antiochus IV was fighting in Egypt, and he was setting up kingdoms, and a false rumor arose in Judea that he'd been killed. Back to Israel. We're going right back home again. And this prompted that, remember Jason, who had been deposed as high priest? Now, he's not the one that was murdered, but it caused him to raise up an army of 1,000 men and attack Jerusalem. He wants his priesthood back. So his army captured the city, and he forced the high priest Manaus to take refuge in the Acra fortress in Jerusalem. But while fighting, that news of that fighting in Jerusalem reached Antiochus IV, he took it to mean that all of Israel was revolting against him. Why he didn't get all the words right. Remember, they didn't have satellite TV, and they didn't have cell phones. He just got the rumor Jerusalem was in chaos. He didn't understand that this high priest Jason had caused it for himself. He thought the whole area was against him. Now, he's not going to deal well with this. So, Antiochus IV left Egypt. And on his way home, he was so mad that Jerusalem was rebelling against him, he thought. Remember, it's not true. They were really rebelling against this Jason. Then on his way home, he and his armies marched against Jerusalem. I'm sure they're totally surprised by this. He commanded his soldiers to kill everyone they encountered, every man, woman, and child. And within the space of 3 days, his forces had slaughtered between 40,000 and 80,000 residents of Jerusalem on this bad rumor. Now, a similar number, that same amount, were captured and sold into slavery to other countries. Just shipped them out. And he was not satisfied with that. That was not bad enough. So here's what I want you to take note of. He goes into the temple because he knows that's real important to the Jews. And he was guided by this misfit priest, Menelaus, who wasn't really a priest. He just called himself that. But he had allied himself with him so he wouldn't die. He took all the holy vessels, including the golden altar, the menorah, the table for showbread, the cups for the drink offerings, the bowls, the golden censers, the curtain, the crowns, the gold decoration at the front of the temple. He took all the silver and gold, as well as all the hidden treasures which he found, and he took them back with him. After appointing Phrygia Philip as governor in Jerusalem, Antiochus IV then left Jerusalem. So he stripped the temple at this point. because he's so mad. And he believed a lie, which is just what Daniel said, that he would be moved against the Holy Covenant. He took everything out of the temple. Okay, verse 29. At the appointed time, he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter. This is going to be an unusual thing happen. Meanwhile in Egypt, meanwhile back down in Egypt, the two brothers who were kind of fighting with each other, but yet trying to ally Ptolemy the 6th and 7th, reconciled and agreed to share power. Now they're co-kings, the 6th and the 7th. This annulled Antiochus the 4th alliance with this, Ptolemy the 6th and caused his loss of control over all of the Ptolemy's kingdom. Because of this, in 168 B.C., Antiochus IV once again sought to go to war against Egypt. However, this time he would not have the same success. Remember what happened. He thought he was an ally with his nephew the 6th, cheating him. But the 6th Ptolemy understood what was happening and allied with Ptolemy 7, his brother, and they go against Antiochus and kick him out. And now Antiochus IV is so mad he's coming back and in full fury against Egypt again. Guess where he passes through? He passes through Israel. Verse 30. For ships from Cyprus, by the way, Kittim is Cyprus. You may insert that. For ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Because those Ptolemy brothers knew that they couldn't have defeat this Antiochus IV and his army alone. They knew that. They began appealing to Rome. Remember I told you the rising command on the block. And they began seeking help from Rome. And in order to check the threat of that, the Romans agreed to provide assistance to the Ptolemies. The ships from Kittim here refer to the ships which brought the Roman legions. First time we're seeing this. Those ships from Cyprus are bringing Roman soldiers into Egypt to help them against Antiochus IV. Rome is starting to be a real power to be reckoned with. And so as Antiochus IV and his army marched toward Alexandria, they were met by three Roman senators led by Gaius, Popilius, Linnaeus, in Eleusis, a suburb of Alexandria. There, the Roman ambassador, Popilius, delivered to Antiochus IV the Senate's demand that he withdraw immediately from Egypt. I'm sure he was shocked to see the Roman garrisons all lined up against him in Egypt. When the king requested time for consultation, Popilius drew a circle around Antiochus IV with a stick he was carrying and told him not to leave that circle until he gave his response. This is humiliating to Antiochus IV. This one act by this Roman general so enrages him, you're not going to believe what he does. The king of the north was astonished at the display of Roman arrogance. But after a brief time, he could only do what the Romans demanded. He was so surrounded by the Roman garrisons there in Egypt. And that one general, to make fun of him, drew a circle around him and said, "You're not moving out of here until you tell us what you're going to do." He was humiliated. And so, he turned tail and left. And on his way back to Syria, he's so humiliated, he's so outraged by what the Romans had done to him, that he tried to ease the sting of that humiliation that he had suffered at the hands of the Romans by taking out his frustration on the Jews in Judea. This is the part that Jesus is going to refer to. This is the big ta-da of this whole chapter. And I've been working all these verses to get you to this point. He has come against Egypt thinking he's going to win, and he's surprised to be met by Rome. Rome is so strong, they play with him. They say, "Oh, you think you're so big, you don't want to tell us what you're going to do? Here, we're drawing a circle, don't you move." And he has to acquiesce to the Romans because they're so strong that he turns tails and goes back home north. And on the way, he's so outraged and so embarrassed that he's vicious anyway. This is the kind of guy he is. Remember, look at all the people he's had murder. That he's going to take his rage out on Jerusalem. And here's what happens. I'm in verse 31. And the forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. A good reference, and I don't have time to do it today, is go back and read Matthew 24. Jesus refers to when you see the abomination of desolation as purported by Daniel the prophet. In other words, when you see this exact thing I'm going to read to you about happen in end times, know this. Here's what you do. This is huge. I want to explain this. I know we're long. This is lots of history and lots of intrigue, but here's where we've worked up to. He's been embarrassed. He's been defeated. And by golly, he's not going to take it. He's going to take on the little guy on the block, which is Jerusalem, which has no defense. And he's going to go in and he's going to do the abomination of desolation. And by the way, the abomination is always an outrage using an idol or a false religion. So that's what that means. The historical context for this is Antiochus the Fourth is actually the person that does this. And here's what he does. He goes into Jerusalem. Antiochus the Fourth's army desecrates the temple, and he stops all the daily sacrifices. He marches into the temple and he says to priests, "Stop it right now. Anyone that does it, you're murdered. If I see your Torah, if I see your scriptures out, I'm murdering anyone. My soldiers have orders, no scripture anywhere. You read it out loud, you read it in private, you're dead. You have anything to do with this religion of the Jews, you're dead. The history says that two mothers had their little boys circumcised about the same time. He ripped them open and he drugged them and their little boys through town. He said, you will not do anything that has to do with this Jewish God. This is what he's doing. And then on the 15th of Kislev, which is in December of 168 BC, the Syrians built a pagan altar over the altar of burnt offering in the temple and placed an image of Zeus Olympus upon it. He believed it was an image of him. Antiochus IV believed he was the reincarnate Zeus. He believed by placing the pagan image of Zeus on the altar, they would be worshiping him. This is in the Holy of Holies. 10 days later, on the 25th of Kislev, a swine's flesh was offered on the altar to Zeus, to him. He tried to destroy Judaism, where he made it a capital crime to read the Torah, do sacrifices, or do anything to God's law. If they were caught, it's instant death. The Maccabean family, one of the last true strongholds of the Jewish heroes, became so enraged with what was happening that they began a 3-year plan to destroy him and to get back the temple, especially after the idol had been erected and the slaughtering of the pig and the pig's blood splattered all over the temple. According to John 22, you can go back and read that, it begins pointing to the Maccabeans. If you want to read in the Apocrypha, it's very, very well to read this story. Jesus appoints to the abomination of desolation on the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24. And that abomination or false worship was the ultimate extreme of this. Let me tell you what happened with the Maccabeans. They were so outraged. And they are a warring family. They're a very godly Jewish family. They were not afraid of being killed, like some of them were. That they began a 3-year undercover plan to restore the temple and get rid of Antiochus IV. When they finally take the temple, it takes them 3 years to do it. When they finally take the temple back, they cleanse it and they make it good enough for sacrifices again. They restore the true religion. We hear it today. It's the celebration of Hanukkah. Hanukkah is not the little funsy, cutesy things you hear. It is the Maccabeans restoring this temple, taking away from this godless Antiochus IV, Epiphanes. That is, if you don't understand Hanukkah, you've got to read Daniel 11:31 to get what that even means. And I'm in 32. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. So after venting his anger on the Jews, trying to get even, trying to make himself feel better, he desecrated the temple. Antiochus IV decreed that his entire kingdom should become one people, each giving up his own customs, so that he declares all the rest of the kingdom of the north is going to be after him, worshiping him or Zeus. The other peoples under his rule accepted Antiochus' fourth command. But because of this flattering approach, many of the people of Israel also forsook the law because they were cowards. So they began worshiping him and adopted his religion. That's not surprising. It happened all through the Old Testament. But Antiochus IV commanded a change in all the ordinance of God. No sacrifices were ever to be offered in the sanctuary except to him. The Sabbaths and feasts were never to be done, and they were profaned, and the Jews were not to circumcise their sons. Upon the pain of death, they were commanded, if they profaned his religion, that he would have them murdered. Antiochus IV appointed inspectors. This reminds me of the German Gestapos. Inspectors to watch Jews and commanded the cities of Judah to offer pagan sacrifices. Yet many in Israel stood firm and rejected those innovations, and many died. The Maccabean revolt led to the Hasmonean era, which lasts until Rome. So they do finally win out. So just interesting on that point. On verse 33, and those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plunder. He killed a lot of people. Whenever Antiochus IV's men found copies of the Torah, they tore them to pieces and burned them. They killed the people holding them. When they were found in possession of Torah, they were often executed in the city square. And according to Antiochus IV's decree, women who had their children circumcised were put to death along with their entire families. And still, many people in Israel stood firm and chose to worship the true God. There's always a remnant. What I know about this is, this story is true. There's always a remnant. There's going to be a remnant in the last days. Verse 34. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue, as the historical book of Maccabees shows. The decrees of Antiochus IV eventually led to a rebellion started by the priest Matthias and his five sons, including Judas Maccabees. He and his family had fled from Jerusalem to Modin when the Seleucid forces took the city. And there the Matthiases killed a Jew who was sacrificing according to Antiochus IV's command, as well as the king's officer who was forcing them to sacrifice. From this first act of rebellion, a guerrilla war began against the forces of Antiochus IV. And after the death of his father Matthias in 167 BC, Judas Maccabee defeated the large army of Antiochus IV's general Apollonius. And this victory helped Judas gather a sizable force to which they never turned back and were finally able to restore the temple. Hanukkah, the celebration of Hanukkah. Verse 35. And some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. When the Gentiles around Judea heard of that victory over the Seleucids, they became angry, and they began to kill Jews who lived among them. Judas Maccabee and his brother Simon went out and fought against Gentiles who sought to kill them. And after the deaths of Judas Maccabees in 161, persecution continued on the Jews, as it still does to this day. But beginning with the Maccabees' leadership of the rebellion of Antiochus IV, the rule of the Hasmoneans, named after their grandfather, lasted from 168 until 37 BC. 130 years. The words, that's what this verse is telling, the words until the time of the end refer to the end of the second period of Jewish sovereignty. They were able to rule God as God was in command for 130 years. But until the time of the end, the appointed time then refers to the 70 weeks of the years that Gabriel had told Daniel earlier in Daniel 9, which then led to the appearance of the Messiah. That's where we're stopping today. The last few verses of this chapter really go with chapter 12. It's a better break to put those last few verses with chapter 12. Chapter 12 is rather short. It's 12 verses, so it'll easily happen. And what I'd like you to know that in that particular group that we just read, in those 35 verses, there were 135 prophetical statements in those 35 verses. If you think you're overwhelmed, if you're going, then what you should know is this. That was written 550 years before Jesus. And when you lay what Daniel wrote as that prophecy down against history, it matches exactly. There's not one of those kings that's out of order. There's not one of those intrigues that's written on the wrong king. It is perfect. This is the prophecy that most people don't like. And when we understand who Antiochus Epiphanes is, Antiochus the Fourth, I want you to get a picture of how that's going to lay on top of the Antichrist at the end times. Next week, we're going to really lay that on top of him. And I hope that this time you got to see it. It would be important if you had time to review Daniel 8, the last part of it, about the little horn, who we know is the Antichrist, because he's the one that you might remember was called the King of Fierce Countenance. Antiochus Epiphanes, called the vile person. It's the same root. The next section of 11 will be included, and it will end our study of Daniel. What can I say about this chapter? I think I pulled in enough life lessons of what I think it means for us today? And I think you could find 100 more. I think you can look at this and say, God doesn't miss a dot or a tittle. And he gave us prophecy so that we might know, that we would know, that we'd know. I'm going to end with an interesting reference. And you may wonder about it, and I hope I can bring it back home to you. I am in Titus 2. I'm in the 11th verse. For the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men, teaching us that, denying ungodliness and worldly lusts, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present age, looking for the blessed hope and glorious appearing of our great God and Savior Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us that he might redeem us from every lawless deed and purify for himself his own special people, zealous for good works. I get overwhelmed by the horribleness of these people and of Israel and of me. I get overwhelmed by sin. I get overwhelmed by how my heart so quickly can go to unrighteousness. And then I'm reminded to read Titus. And I'm reminded to read what the Apostle Paul says, that it's for the grace of God that we can endure this, looking forward to the blessed hope that is our Savior. And that is my prayer today, that through this, you can see Jesus. God, we come to you in the name of your Son, Yahshua. Oh, God, we thank you for him. We thank you for the words of this ancient prophecy that still hold truth for us today. And I ask that through Titus and through Ezekiel and through Isaiah and Daniel, we can just see you more and more and more and more. And Lord, let us learn to love you with our lives. We ask that in the name of Jesus. Amen.